fortunate that I didn't get to reach a couple people. I still am hoping to talk to Fred Haler about a little bit about the center here's history. I miss talking to Hannah, which was unfortunate, but I'll ask you a couple questions about that.
Well, Fred, I understand, is very happy out on the West Coast.
Yeah, he's been out there a little while.
He's retired, you know.
This is John Rivette on October 24th, 1991, with Charles Killingsworth, an interview about school labor industrial relations and labor education by MSU over the years. And, I got a couple pages of questions. If in 45 minutes or so we're not done, well, I guess we could reschedule. I don't want to kill either of us. But before I get into asking a little bit about the school, can I just, for the record, find out from you when you were born and how and why did you get interested in labor relations?
Uh-huh. All right. That's quickly answered. I was born on, believe it or not, January 1st, 1917.
That's an interesting date.
And I lived in a fairly small town in southwest Missouri called Springfield. You probably heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to high school there. And there was a state college about two blocks from where we lived at the time. So since this was in the middle of the Depression, it was natural for me to go to the state college rather than the state university or any of the other institutions that I was interested in. At the state college, one of the very powerful, very intelligent women on the faculty there was also, she was a professor of English, but she was also a coach of the debate squad. And I was talked into, matter of fact, I wasn't talked into it, I just decided I wanted very much to have more contact with her, and I joined the debating team. And the first year that I was in the debate squad, as we called it, there was a national question for debate. Some central authority had put that out. And there was something about the minimum wage. We should have the minimum wage, or we should not have it. We should have it higher, or we should have it lower. Well, in these college debate squads, you have to be prepared to argue both sides of a question. Sometimes you're on the affirmative, sometimes you're on the negative. And I was lucky enough to have a capable partner on the debate squad, and we worked very hard under the guidance of Dr. Craig, who was the English professor. She was also chairman of the economics department. But she was especially interested in the debate squad. So we worked hours and hours and hours. And, well, to be frank about it, we won quite a few debates.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it was the fact that both my partner and I had a gift for extemporaneous rebuttal.
Okay.
And so we got some silver cups at tournaments and so forth and so on. Then the next year, which I think was my senior year at college, I was pretty busy. I was the editor of the campus newspaper, and I was also a member of the debate squad, and I was carrying a full load of courses. The second year was, pretty sure it was, it had to do with the National Labor Relations Act. I think the affirmative was the National Labor Relations Act should be repealed, and the negative was it should not be repealed, it should be retained exactly as it is. So there was another several months of pretty intensive library work on this question.
Would all of that have been a year or two after the sit-down strikes, then?
No. Wait a minute. Let me. I'm born in 1917. It's made me 10 years old and 27. 20 years old
and 37.
37.
So you'd,
yes, I believe.
So be right about then. So it'd be a big national debate about unionism and the CIO and sit-down strikes.
Right, right. I'm glad you reminded me. That was the case. And so the Daily newspaper was our research source as much as books. Well, I spent a lot of time and was really quite interested in this question. And in preparing for debating, I came across the names of a number of professors at the University of Wisconsin, which at that time, I think it's safe to say, was the outstanding university in the world in labor economics and related fields. So it was my burning desire upon graduation to get up to the University of Wisconsin in Madison and work under some of these famous people whose books I'd been reading. And fortunately, that worked out. I was lucky enough to to get a loan from one of my undergraduate professors, enough to finance me for the first semester at Wisconsin. So I got on the bus, went to Wisconsin, and I was a little bewildered. I'd never been in such a large university before, and it was really quite large, and the classes were quite large.
Was that to seek a master's or PhD in economics, or?
Well, I first went to.
Was it to finish your
to
undergrad?
Oklahoma. Oh no, I'd finished the.
Okay, at the State College.
Undergraduate work at the State College in Springfield. I finished a master's degree at what's now Oklahoma State University up in Stillwater. And I wrote a master's thesis on, I'm pretty sure it was on the National Labor Relations Act and the National Labor Relations Board. Well, at Wisconsin, there was an interesting little incident. I think the second year I was at Wisconsin, the faculty announced a graduate seminar. Forget the subject. I think it was something like the National Labor Relations Board. And if any student, any students that wished to be members of this seminar, should apply and. The faculty would examine their credentials and notify those that they wanted to be in the seminar and notify the others that they didn't want to be in the seminar. Well, this is the only time in my career, I think in my lifetime, that I was in a seminar where the professors outnumbered the students. But Wisconsin had I would say 10 or 12 professors whose names were very familiar to me because I'd read a lot of their works. It was not only in the economics department, there were some in the sociology department and some in the law school. Lloyd Garrison, name you may have heard, was the dean of the law school. Nate Feinsinger, a professor of law, was in the seminar, and as I say, there were seven or eight professors, and they tried to keep the student enrollment down to something slightly less.
Who led the seminar?
Oh, I think, as I recall, they took turns, and it, of course, it was very stimulating.
Is this like Perlman and?
Selig Perlman was in on it. Wasn't exactly his cup of tea. He's much more interested in labor history, theory of the labor movement, than he was things like the National Labor Relations Board, which was, again, the subject of the seminar. And I pulled out my master's thesis and did some more work on it. Well, I was lucky enough to be assigned to Lloyd Garrison, as my thesis supervisor. I think by that time I had gotten a strong suggestion from Edwin Witte, who was the chairman of the economics department at the time. He said, too much has been written already about the National Labor Relations Act, the National Labor Relations Board. So I would suggest that you think about doing your doctoral dissertation on state labor relations acts. There are, I think there were 8 or 10 of them. And he said, read up on that a little bit and consider it and see what you think. Well, under Garrison, I decided to start work on the state labor relations acts. I think this was my second year at Wisconsin when this seminar was held.
And these would be the little Wagner Acts, as they were called?
Yes, okay. Yes. Wisconsin had one, Minnesota had one, New York had the beginnings of one, and so on down the list. Well, I worked pretty hard. Instead of going home the second Christmas that I was at Wisconsin, I decided to practically live in the library instead of spending the money and the time to go all the way down to Springfield, which was in those days a pretty long trip. So I did that. I did a paper for the seminar under Lloyd Garrison's supervision, and Professor Witte also looked at what I was writing on the State Labor Relations Act. He said, keep it up. And I did. And then I had an opportunity to go down to Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and work on a research project there. The war had just begun at this point. It hadn't. The World War had begun. The U.S. was not yet engaged in the war. They didn't get into the war until Pearl Harbor, December 7th, I think it was, 1941. So I thought Johns Hopkins would be a very good place to be because it's only 45 minutes from Washington. Mm-hmm. Very, very frequent train service. So I went to Johns Hopkins, and the man who was director of the research project, we were planning a 3-volume index to trade union publications. Mm-hmm. And he got involved on a full-time basis, I think the OPA, Office of Price Administration, called him to Washington, so I became the labor, well, professor was wrong because I was not far from being a professor. I was the labor instructor. Nobody else had any background in the labor field. And I was also drafted to teach a course in statistics, which I think I enjoyed more more than my students did.
This was a research on labor union publications?
Trade union publications, okay, was the title of it.
Around 39 or 40 is the time.
It was published in the 40s, okay, in the early 40s. Well, I'll bring this to an end.
That's fine.
I also got involved in some of the Washington activities. Oh, yes, this... this is a rather important point. I got a draft deferment. I had a a nervous stomach, and my doctor said you would be a wreck a month after you got into the Army. So I said, "Well, can you tell that to the draft people?" He said, "I'll write a letter. I think you ought to see so-and-so, another doctor down the corridor." I wanted to get the damned draft thing settled one way or the other, so I volunteered for the Army. The Army turned me down for the stomach problem. And then I think I was a volunteer for the Army, you know, because I wanted this thing settled one way or the other. And by that time I was married. My wife was working on the research project at Johns Hopkins. And so I went to be examined for the draft, and I was rejected as a 4F because I had this stomach problem. I later discovered I had surgery for a bum appendix, and after the surgery, which is a relatively minor thing, the doctor said, you know, I think that your stomach problem is that you have had chronic appendicitis.
All those years.
Yeah. Well, it had been especially bothersome for about 10 years, taking all kinds of pills, you know, to keep my stomach under control. But anyway, the war was close to being over by that time. And so I got some time that I could spend working on my doctoral dissertation, which of course was still State Labor Relations Act. And after the war ended, I decided that I probably did not have much of a future at Johns Hopkins, because the chairman of the department there was enamored of Princeton. He was always spouting about what a great university Princeton was. And so I thought I needed a show down there. And I got the showdown, and I was out. By that time, I had gone to work for the Social Security Administration in Baltimore. The national headquarters were in Baltimore at that time. And I worked for it was then called the Social Security Board. I worked for that for about a year, and I found enough time to finish that doctoral dissertation, to send it back up to Madison, get it approved, and somebody, I think it was probably Professor Whitty, suggested that he thought I ought to send the dissertation to the University of Chicago Press and see if they'd like to publish it as a book. And to my great good fortune, that worked out. They did a very nice job of printing it up, and so I had a publication before I actually had the PhD degree. Uh-huh. Okay, well, then, as I say, the war was winding down, and a man named Herman Weingarten here at Michigan State, who was the chairman. In those days, it was called, not chairman, but head. He was head of the economics department. He contacted the man that I had been working for at Johns Hopkins. I asked for a recommendation, and it sounded pretty good to me. I came up here, looked the place over, and I rather think that I met President Hanna at that time. Anyway, I was most impressed by President Hanna. He was really a great man. People who knew him when he was at his prime generally have a very high opinion of John Hanna. Anyway, I decided to come up here. I landed here January 1st, 1947.
So on your birthday?
On my birthday.
30th birthday.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I got an associate professorship with tenure. Progressed from, I think I was a temporary instructor at Johns Hopkins, and I was jumped up to associate professor here at MSU. And the salary was more than twice as much as I was making in Baltimore. So it was a very tempting prospect. My wife by then was pregnant, and I remember we had a little contest between us. She was not really a nag, but she was always reminding me, go in there and work on that thesis. And her parents said the same thing, and somebody else said the same thing. And I said, well, I'll tell you, I will bet you that I finish this thesis before you have our baby. And she said, smiled and said, fine. She was a very marvelous person. Came from Boston, and her field was economics, really labor economics. That's why she was hired to work on this research project. And I think I beat her about a month. I took a leave of absence, or I actually resigned. As soon as I got the appointment up here, I resigned at the Social Security Administration. That left me with 2 or 3 clear months to work on the dissertation. And I certainly sat and pounded the typewriter night and day.
But the book was already out, correct?
Which book?
Your...
No, that was the State Labor Relations
Act. Okay, okay.
And the other book, of which I was a co-author, at my insistence, the man who was running the project never showed up. You should at least designate me as the co-author, so he somewhat grudgingly...
On the Trade Union Publications
trade
volumes?
Trade Union Publications.
Uh-huh. What was that called?
Trade Union Publications, :Index.
Okay. So you started here in 47.
Right.
You had an appointment in economics.
Yes.
And at that point, the university had neither labor education nor labor... labor industrial relations section. The center, I understand, starts on your birthday. Everything's on your birthday in January 1st, 56 or something. But
well, I believe that it officially was started January 1st, 1956, but the enabling action had been taken by the Board of Trustees. In fact, I think mm-hmm. it was Agricultural Board something in the middle of 55.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we got some money to run on pending the. Pending the full-fledged birth, we got some money. It was, I think that that money came out of the accounts of a man named Woody Varner. Mm. You ever heard of him?
Yeah.
He was, I'm now coming to the establishment and early years of the, mm-hmm. what was called Labor and Industrial Relations Center, LIRC. I have to go back a little bit. I think it was about the second year that I was here that the dean of the School of Business and Public Service resigned or retired, and the man who was the head of the Department of Economics became the dean of business. And I had been investigating my prospects. I got 4 or 5 different offers of positions. It was a mad time. Just when World War II was over, there were many, many people who had the AB degree, the all but thesis,
uh-huh.
And I had the great advantage of not only having my degree in my hand, I had a book that was published by the University of Chicago Press, which was a very prestigious institution then, and still is, of course. So I was, well, as a matter of fact, I taught at the University of Michigan summer session in, when was it? Sometime along in that, in the early 50s, I believe. No, 1948 it was. Mm. Just the year after I'd gotten up there. I had gotten to know Bill Haber, who was the labor man at the University of Michigan. And he invited me to come down there and teach in the summer session. Well, that had the big advantage of making me decide very firmly I would never try to teach in a summer session again. It's not like the regular year, the academic year. Anyway, Bill Haber and the chairman of economics at Michigan had made an offer to me at about that time. There were two or three other places, Illinois, I think UCLA, and the identities don't matter too much. Anyway, I thought about it a great deal, and talked it over with my wife, who was a labor economist, knew a lot more than the average person. And I decided that I would leave Michigan State and go to the University of Michigan. So I informed Dean Weingarten. He informed John Hanna. John Hanna called up, said he'd like to see me in his office as quickly as possible. So I went over to his office, and he was a very pleasant person to deal with. Do you know him at all?
Just had met him.
Also very persuasive, very persuasive. He topped the Michigan salary offer by about 50%. And this was supposed to be a great favor, a great prize. He said, we'd like for you to stay here and become the head of the Department of Economics. And I said, oh, why? He said, I will tell you this. It is a small department. It is a struggling department. We want to make it one of the strongest departments in the university. And I can assure you that you will have unlimited backing to bring the finest people that you can find in the United States to fill out the economics department. Well, that was a challenge I couldn't turn down. And had a lot of fun for, I guess, 5 years, staffing up the economics department. Many of the people that I recruited are still in the economics department. Anthony Koo, for example, comes to mind. And there were several others from that era who are still active in the economics department. Well, about 1954, President Hanna called me in, and I think he was by then Vice President Woody Varner, and broached the idea of having a labor school at Michigan State. And I said, why? Well, he said some things that he was to repeat many times. After, he said, we have a very extensive extension program and educational program for agriculture. We have a large business department, I forget what it was called, I think it was general business. And we have extension programs for the business people. But more and more, he says, I've watched the development of the university. It has seemed that there is a great lack of opportunities and programs for labor people. And I think he also, no, I guess it was Woody Barnett who talked to me about this after we got out of Mr. Hanna's office. Well, Mr. Hanna said to me, I would like to appoint a committee to consider whether Michigan State should have a labor program. And I'll appoint, I think Weingarten was the business dean, and Woody Varner, and I'd like for you to be the chairman of this committee. You study it for how much or however much time you think it requires, and report back to me what you think we should do to serve the people of this state. Well, Woody Varner pointed to me, said to me, we went down to his office after this meeting, and Woody said, you know, there are big things going on in the state of Michigan. There was a big drive to change the apportionment of the state legislature. State legislature was very top-heavy with labor people, agricultural people. Many of the members were farmers, and the state the districts were laid out in such a fashion that there was a great over-representation of agricultural people at that time. Well, the labor movement had its triumphs of the 30s and the 40s, and it was very active in Michigan. And Mr. Hanna was aware, Woody told me this, Mr. Hanna didn't. Mr. Hanna was very conscious of the fact that the balance of power would shift in the legislature if the reapportionment campaign won out. And this was one reason for his feeling that we should study there was another person involved in this. His name was Don Stevens. You know Don.
Mm-hmm.
Don was a member of the governing board of the university. I'm sure that Don had discussed the matter of services to labor as well as to agriculture and to business. And Mr. Hanna recognized merit in what Don Stevens had to say. And that was what got the thing, got people started talking and studying. Well, I, as chairman of this committee to study the matter, I made a trip, made two or three trips actually, to universities that had labor programs of one kind or another, Illinois, UCLA, Cornell, and some others that don't come to mind immediately. And I had the opportunity, a lot of the directors of these programs were friends or acquaintances of mine that I'd met during the war years, or in the early 40s. Oh yes, there was an organization formed in 48, I think it was, called the Industrial Relations Research Association.
Mm-hmm.
You know about it, I presume. Mm-hmm. You're a member. And through that, we had annual meetings, spring meetings, and I was lucky enough to get acquainted with many of the leading people in this field of services for labor. Well,
mm-hmm.
I came back with one strong recommendation. Well, in the first place, I said we should not undertake anything in this field unless we are prepared to support it adequately, financially. Mm-hmm. And John Hanna said, I'm in favor of that. I recognize that. And I said, the second point is, I do not think that a program exclusively for labor in an organization that is based on this single kind of program is very vulnerable. These were still the days when there was a lot of resistance on the part of business people, mm-hmm. some academicians, some legislatures, some legislators in the state legislature here. Mm-hmm. I said, unless you are willing to support a program considerably broader than what we've been talking about so far, I think this undertaking will self-destruct, or at least be in a position where others can come in and kill the thing. So I said, I think that any organization that is set up should have three interrelated programs. There should be a program of research and services, extension programs for the labor people. There should be in the middle a research service, research program, and also a program of services for business, exclusively in the labor relations field. We had trouble with the College of Business, School of Business. It was College of Business by then, I think. And many of the faculty members were spoiling for a turf battle. mm-hmm. And they tried their best to block any undertakings by this institution, which came to be established. And we had some friction there for several years. But anyway, Mr. Hanna went along with, I would say, everything that I recommended. I don't recall any recommendation that this committee of three people, and I wrote the report, and Woody Varner put his name to it, and Dean Weingarten put his name to it. I think he accepted the program and the recommendations 100%, and also made it clear that if we ran short on money, come and see him, and he would try to dig up some to get the show on the road. So, really, before the legislature acted, which was in mid-1955, I was given the second assignment of touring the country and spending a lot on long-distance charges to staff this operation. I think that we were very fortunate. I heard reports about a man that was said to be very capable, in fact, probably the best man in the United States or in the world, for that matter, for a labor extension program and some research in the labor field. His name was Fred Haler. Well, I went after Fred, and we became friends. And for several weeks, discussed the possibility of his coming here and developing this program. Don Stevens knew Fred, I think. Some connection prior to this. At one point, Fred turned us down, and I made a trip to where he was living at that time. I forget now just where it was. Tried talking to him, and I think sold him on coming to Michigan State, which was a very fortunate development for us in establishing this labor program. for the associate director in charge of the research program. Again, turned out we were very fortunate. There was a young man at Harvard, I believe he was an instructor at Harvard, working on his PhD, of course. His name was Jack Stieber. And I went about recruiting him. I called a few of my friends. Jack was active in the Boston Regional War Labor Board. And one of my good friends, a man named Saul Wallen, rest his soul, was closely connected with this Boston Labor Relations Board and also with Harvard University. Now, so I called Saul and said, just between you and me, Saul, how do you size up this fellow Jack Stieber? He's got strong letters of recommendation, but you and I have known each other for years. I know you wouldn't bullshit me if I can use that term. And he said, oh my, if you hire Jack Stieber to come out to your new center, it would be a 10 strike. So I put on, doubled the pressure. And as I said once in a retrospective speech, we were most fortunate because we got not only Jack Stieber, we got his wife. She's had a rather noted career here on the campus. And after I resigned as director of the center, which I think by that time was a school, yes, it was a school, Jack became the director and served 25 years, I think. Did a marvelous job, very popular, not only in the school, but in the university. Jack was active in the Academic Council, and so forth. Well,
why are you doing the three? Was it Rogers or McFarland who was asked to head the personal management extension?
McFarland was the first one. And it was a choice that was dictated by the fact that he was already a professor of management in the school of business here on the campus. And I thought that he might be a bridge to school of business and cut down on some of the static that we were getting from these people about our encroaching on their turf. Well, Dalt was a very pleasant person, but not very forceful. And he didn't have much luck in persuading the college business people to lay off. And finally, the senior professors in the school, persuaded Dalt to go back to his professorship in, I think it was in management. We had a vacancy to fill. And, I failed to mention that one of my undertakings, even before the school was actually established, one of my undertakings was to set up an advisory committee for the labor program, an advisory committee for the management program. Now, where was I?
Well, we got a couple directors
We
can pick them up.
We did have an all-star cast, particularly on the labor advisory program. I won't run down the long list of names, about 10 or 12 people. Ed Cushman was one.
Was Brendan Sexton one?
Yes.
Okay.
And there were, as I say, about a dozen others whose names you would recognize. I'd have to stop and think for a minute to call them back. Well, and we had a similar advisory committee on the management side. And I talked to three or four of the best-known people on this management side, and, you know, they were very strongly in favor of Rogers for the job that Dalt McFarland had vacated. Well, I knew Rogers slightly. He used to go to meetings around the state, you know, and he'd be there. And struck me as a pleasant enough fellow. Seemed to be easy to get along with. So we appointed him as the director of the labor program.
The personnel management program.
Personnel management program. Which was a great mistake. It became clear fairly soon. He was virulently anti-labor. He was a rather eccentric person in much of his thinking, but he never missed an opportunity to say something nasty about labor. Well, I think he lasted only about a year, as I remember it. Maybe it probably seemed longer than that at the time, but he just wasn't the man for the job. So I asked him to remove himself from the school. He was outraged, and well, to get him to accept this, he was personnel director for some Detroit firm, Detroit Ball Bearing, I think, something like that.
After he left here, or simultaneously?
No, before he came.
Before here, okay.
But he'd left that. I'm not sure how secure his tenure was. Okay. Down there, and he came up here. I think he continued to live in Detroit and commuted up here 2-3 days a week. And he got into a big hassle with the people over in the School of Business. And I think, as a matter of fact, he filed a lawsuit. And I think he won his lawsuit. He was a lawyer himself. And he got a court order directing the School of Business to reinstate him as a full professor of management, which they did.
Is that after you asked him to leave as associate director?
Oh, yes,
okay.
Yes. Well, one other project in the early days that I think helped to give us some momentum, undertook a lecture series. And we got people like Walter Reuther to come out and give a lecture. John Kenneth Galbraith came out and gave us a lecture. And there were some others that don't come to mind immediately. But it was, I think, a very successful program, and it did give us some momentum. And got our name known to many people around the state and outside the state as well. And Jack Stieber was here by then, and he edited the speeches that were given, the lectures, public lectures, and they were published, I believe, by the MSU Press. It was a very successful undertaking, didn't cost as much as you might think, plane fare and token honorarium.
I've seen it. It's a nice collection.
Yeah.
It was nice. If you don't mind, if any of these are personal, we can drop it, but I wanted to go back and ask you about a couple of things that I had checked that we kind of covered here.
Mm-hmm.
Was my understanding that prior to the center, that MSU, under continuing education, for a couple of years, did some kind of labor education program under Stoy Menton? Does that make any sense? 53
yes.
And 54?
There was a token program in continuing education. Woody Varner was in charge of continuing education at that time. He came out of the School of Agriculture. He was very familiar with the extension activities that were undertaken for labor. And he was a very strong, enthusiastic supporter of this whole idea. of a center or school of labor and industrial relations. So we inherited Stowe Minton, who was one of the staff members.
He stayed on with the center?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I don't remember exactly when he left or for what reason, but he was around for several years.
And I think he had, I believe he had been at the U of M Labor Ed Center when the big GM 1948 fiasco occurred,
yes.
And then came here after that. I've never talked to him,
yeah.
But I ran across that reference and I wondered, he was one of your staff people for a while.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But that was a rather token program, is what you were saying.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, shoestring operation.
Okay.
And we were very generously treated, I would say, with regard to money.
Mm-hmm.
And this was John Hanna's doing.
Well,
he was as good as his word. He said, just tell me what money you need, and I'll do my best to find it for you.
I was going to ask you, the center's relations with the university president and administration were always pretty good.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I understand during the years from 56 to 62 or so that the center was under five deans somehow. I read a reference to that.
A committee of deans?
Or somehow that it was under a multiple of deans. Do you recall that, or that being an issue? Or?
Matter of fact, I'd forgotten this, but we did have a committee, I forget what it was called, composed of Dean Weingarten, Vice President Varner, and myself, the three of us. I don't think any other teams were involved. And Varner and Weingarten were not especially knowledgeable in this field, Varner more so than Weingarten. So we had that set up. Well, let me come to a rather sad tale. Sometime in the early 60s.
I have 62.
62.
If we're talking about the Senate hearing.
Yes. At about this time, Rogers was asked to leave the staff here in the School of Labor and Industrial Relations, or it was still Labor and Industrial Relations Center. And he was very, very belligerent and indignant about that. He reluctantly went over to the School of Business and got into a big hassle with them over there. And I would say it's my belief that he was responsible for interesting a state senator who was an avowed member of the John Birch Society. Have you heard of that society?
Yeah. Are you talking about Senator Francis? Or somebody else.
Francis, I believe, was his name.
He's the one whose name appears on most of the...
That, then Francis it was. I'd forgotten it. Anyway, we spent, I'd say, well, Rogers had cleaned out his filing case in his office before he left. He had a lot of internal documents that he carried off with him. And he fed all of these to Senator Francis, and Senator Francis said, oh, this is a communist undertaking, something like that. And so he thought that there should be a legislative investigation of this wild plan on their activities. He got the state Senate, matter of fact, I think the whole legislature, to support him, authorize him to conduct a hearing. I think there were two or three other members, but he was the spark plug, and Rogers was the electricity to operate the spark plug. It was an annoyance and very time-consuming. It soon got to be so ridiculous that you couldn't really take it seriously. Anyway, he had me on the witness stand, of course, for better part of a day. Rogers had fed him some dirt on me. For example, I had used university money to travel to Paris and meet a young woman in Paris who was applying for a job here. And isn't that a hell of a thing to have a university professor doing? So soon after the hearings began, the senator looked at a note and said, "It's my understanding you traveled to Paris and you met a young woman there and she was looking for a job. And how do you account for this? Do you think that's sound university policy?" And my answer to him was, "Senator, I was on leave of absence during that time. I paid every red cent that my trip to Paris and to Italy and Germany and Denmark and so forth, I paid every penny. In fact, I took a half a dollar out of my pocket to buy a cup of coffee for this young woman that was being interviewed. We have an informal rule at the university that people are not hired for tenure positions unless they have been interviewed by someone in the university." I said, "And not only that, Senator, the young woman and I had coffee one fine morning, and my wife and two children were in a room just upstairs in the same hotel where this interview took place. And we thought that this was much more sensible. My role in this thing did not cost the university one penny, except that, of course, I was on partial pay."
Was this a sabbatical we're talking
about?
Yeah,
sabbatical.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And I had my family with me.
So that was part of asked during the Senate investigation of the school.
Yeah, this is a scandalous thing, you know. Here's this guy goes out there, and who knows what his price for considering her was, and so on and so forth. And I went into the restroom at the middle of this so-called investigation, and two of the lawyers that the senator had helping him, two of those lawyers came in to the men's room and got into stalls. And one said to the other, "You know, I think we've been losing ground since we started." And the other one said, "Losing ground? Hell, we never had any ground."
Do you remember the LPS film that was part of the Senate discussion?
Oh, yes, yes. This was a project of Fred Haler's. He had a friend who was a photographer. And we made several small movies. And this was one of Senator Francis's main lines of attack. This guy, Haler, or Holer, I think he called him, made this film to show around the state here, and it is sheer communist propaganda. Well, we played the damned movie for the whole assembly, a big bunch of people were sitting listening to all of this, and Senator Francis's big point of criticism was that here was a man playing the part of a businessman. I forget now just who it was. I think it was maybe the photographer. And he was talking, he and a secretary were in a bar, seated at a table. The male said to her, "Well, this may be a little dry, would you like a drink before we get started?" She said, "Oh, fine." And this was communist propaganda. There was this guy coming on to her, you know, God only knows he wanted to score with her.
Was this in the press a lot, this investigation?
All the newspapers.
The local paper picked it up?
Yeah, the local papers picked it up.
Okay.
Just one, a couple more little points. At one point in the hearing, which I attended throughout, of course, during a very brief recess, I think after my examination by the senator, one of the reporters, let me see how this was. Oh, yeah. One of the reporters from a newspaper was talking to another and said, you know, as this thing progresses, I see more and more witches flying around in the hearing room. So press was not very supportive of this Birch Society professor. And he got together a report, which I strongly suspect was written for him by this man Rogers. Nobody paid much attention to it. I think he got a few lines in the newspaper. At some banquet, 6 or 8 months after the Francis report was issued, one of the reporters, matter of fact, it was a female, who asked Mr. Hanna, there was a question period at a dinner. It was asked by a young female reporter, have you gotten the Francis report? He looked at her and said, yes, I have. She said, what are you going to do with it? He said, I'm going to read it, file it, and forget it. That was the end of that.
How would you characterize President Hanna during this period of the center's getting publicity for its being communist influenced?
He wasn't taken in a bit.
Uh-huh.
He and I had two or three talks about this in preparation for the hearings. Woody Varner was, I think he was still here at that time. Unfortunately, he left around about this time. But he was pretty well informed about our program, what we were doing. So Mr. Hanna was kept well informed, and Mr. Hanna, he was 100% support right down the line.
Now, all of this was under Jack Stieber being actually the director, correct?
No, I was the director.
You were
when
still?
When the Francis report came out.
Okay.
Let me see. I believe that this investigation took place in 1959 or 60. Do you have the date?
I've got it down wrong, apparently.
Well, I just got back from the sabbatical. I had the sabbatical in 58.
Okay.
So that would put it 59 or 60 for the
Is 59 when you stepped down as director?
Let me see. I think it was 60.
Okay. I had him the other way, so.
Yeah, well, I had a talk with President Hanna and with Woody Varner back in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
Of the operation here, and I had said that I did not want to be the director of a center or a school of labor and industrial relations for the rest of my life. I wanted someday, not in the too distant future, someday I hope to go back to being a professor. Well, I'd been chairman of the economics department for took it over, I think, in 48, the fall of 48. And that's right, I was director for 4 years, 10 years, which I think is a record for that department.
Well, I'd wondered how you decided to step down as director. I was going to ask
you. It was
in
the back of my mind all the time.
Uh-huh.
And in this sabbatical in 58, We took a steamer to, well, to England first, took a car along. And I had hours and hours to sit and think at that time. I'd been rather frantic, you know, back home with the phone ringing and people coming in to complain about this or that or the other thing, the Rogers problem. And I decided that, well, I had served for 4 years as the director of the school. I think the foundations had been laid. The positions had been filled with generally top-notch people, except for this Rogers incident. That's one of my big mistakes. Only one in an operation of this kind, I think, is perhaps par for the course. But I'd had it in my mind all through the 50s. Being the chairman of the economics department was a temporary assignment, in my viewpoint. Stayed longer than I had anticipated that I would. And when I got back from my sabbatical, I told Woody Varner and Mr. Hanna that I would like to make arrangements for my switching to a professorship without any administrative duties. I said, I think I've had enough administrative work to last me the rest of my life. Well, Mr. Hanna didn't like it, and he resisted. Finally, this probably ought to be off the record, but it came to the point where...
You want to talk?
That's all right.
Well, I can't.
Came to the point where I actually wrote a letter of resignation. It was a friendly letter. And I simply stated briefly that I had wanted to live the life of a professor once the school was established, or the center. It was still the center then. It was made the school after the Senate investigation. I said the time had come. There would be no better time that I could foresee to put somebody else in the directorship, and I would simply be... Well, I had talked with Woody Varner about the idea of a university professorship, and he painted it in very rosy tones. And I had taken many of the people that I was trying to recruit, both for the economics department and for the center. I had taken them in to see a man whose name I can't remember, he was a vice president or a provost. And he would describe the university professorship as a great recruiting device, you know. So I said, all I want is a university professorship, which apparently was quite a bit. Well, I wrote that letter and left town on some errand. Gone a couple of days, got back, message on my desk, please call President Hanna. So I called him, and he said, oh, I got your letter. I said, good. He said, well, my reaction to it is we all make mistakes. You should stay on as director of the center and appoint some people to do the work for you, which was his approach. Delegate just as much as possible. I said, I've tried that, and it is not really feasible at this level of operation. And we've got a very powerful candidate for the directorship, and, well, that's how it worked out. Okay. Jack Stever was appointed director, 60 or 61, I don't remember just how long. Just when that was. It was when I stepped out of the position, mm-hmm. Jack stepped into it. And, of course, I'm sure you know about Jack's administration.
Mm-hmm. I believe he was, if not on leave, doing something over in Europe when he was called about this switch himself, if
that's,
I remember
that's possible.
Right. Something of that. I remember right, I read someplace you were the second university professor? The second person with that title?
I think that's right. There, and one other man whose name I can't recall.
I didn't see the reference to who had been the first.
Yes. It was a man in one of the social sciences, I believe.
I just wonder, you initiated it, is that correct? You sort of requested
well,
to
no.
be it, or
the position, the terms and conditions of the position had been pretty well laid out by Varner and Mr.
Okay.
Hanna. And as I say, it had been explained in my presence at least a half a dozen different times. I talked to Woody Varner about it. As a matter of fact, I'd gone in to see Woody. I had an offer, I think, from the University of Wisconsin. I'd had an offer, and I was very seriously considering it. And I ran to see Woody, and I said, Woody, I've got this offer from Wisconsin, and I think that it's a wonderful opportunity. Woody said, oh, you don't want to go to the University of Wisconsin. They haven't got any money, and they haven't got any program. I said, well, they have freedom, and I would not have any administrative duties at all. And he said, well, we can do that here. Nothing is impossible here that's possible someplace else. And I said, well, I think you ought to discuss this with Mr. Hanna and see if it's agreeable to him. Well, a couple of days, I went back to see Woody, and he said, it's all set. When the time comes that you decide you want to step down as director, you will be a university professor. Well, a couple of years later, I thought the time had come. Woody couldn't remember it, Hanna couldn't remember it. That's why I wrote the letter of resignation.
Okay. Okay.
And they saw that I was dead serious about this resignation. In fact, I was doing more and more arbitration by that time. And instead of going to another university, I thought about it very carefully, and I decided that I would simply devote my full time to arbitration because I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the people that were involved, and I enjoyed the whole process. Well, this university professorship, although a little hard to come by, turned out to be the kind of thing that I was interested in.
The university and the archives has quite a collection of your arbitrations and serving on different panels over
right.
the years. You, I take it that you did enjoy that kind of work
a
great deal.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. One attraction of the university professorship, as Woody and Mr. Hanna described it, was that the central idea of the university professorship was the university professor should have no assigned duties. Doesn't mean you sit on a riverbank and fish all day, but it means you're free to develop whatever talents you might have as fully as you can. You can undertake some outside activities for remuneration, but it's a matter of your own conscience. You are being paid a full-time salary by the university, and you should give something very close to full-time service to the university. And your outside activities should have a demonstrable connection to the teaching that you want to do. Well, we set up this arbitration course in our program after I have left out one development here that should be noticed. After the Senate hearing, after the dust had settled from that, Mr. Hanna decided that we weren't quite well enough insulated from a phrase he was fond of, unfriendly critics. And he talked with Woody, Woody Varner, and they decided that the center should be changed to a school. The program would remain the same, the three main branches would be the same, but the school would be put under the direction of a dean. Mr. Hanna was a little uneasy with any kind of program that did not have a dean overseeing its activities. Well, I was not enthusiastic about that. I was mistaken, because the coursework, the degree program in the school has turned out to be very successful. I'd say it is one of the outstanding programs in the United States. But they went ahead with it, and so we had a School of Labor and Industrial Relations under a dean of social science, whose name I can't call at the moment. And she was a very non-interfering type and gave support where support was needed.
You're talking about Gwen?
Yes.
But she had a predecessor.
The Weingarten, I believe. No.
No, in between the two of them, there was a person who ended up as a vice president of the university, was the dean of the college.
Of social science?
Yeah, but I can't remember the name.
Yeah. I don't think I had any dealings.
It would have been Jack's time
period. Yes. Well, it could be. Did this other dean come in before Gwen or after?
Before. We have one after, too. We have a new dean now, but there was one before. Yeah. Can I go back and ask you some more questions?
Sure.
We're flying through here. You briefly mentioned the advisory committees. Our school here still actively uses them. I wondered if you had any other comments or stories about the labor advisory committee and the relations between unions and the school over the years, particularly those years when you were involved.
Well, I would say that the entry of Michigan State into this field of labor education, along with the programs in research and personnel management, that was very acceptable to labor. I think that we have had very cordial relations with the labor movement. There was a little hassle with Bob Ripas. This is long after I had left the directorship, and it was Jack's problem. But
you heard some Ripas, about that?
Ripas was, as I had got the story, Ripas was ill-advised enough to drive a foreign car to a meeting, a UAW meeting. And the UAW people were outraged, and they got in touch with Don Stevens and Brendan Sexton. They wanted Bob to be fired at first, and of course that was a demand that simply could not be met for that reason. But they compromised by saying, never, never send Ripas out to handle another UAW program. He is persona non grata to the UAW. But Bob had plenty to do without the UAW assignments, so it worked out pretty well. Or there were some complaints about some of the publications. I commissioned LaRue, when he was a member of the staff, I commissioned him to write a little pamphlet on money lending. That's not the title of the pamphlet. But he did that, and some mischievous illustrator put a picture of a building and a vulture sitting on top of the building looking down. And we got a lot of static from some of the, particularly lending programs, the short-term lending program. They wanted me to fire LaRue, and when I told him that could not be done, he said, well, publicly denounce this man. Well, I called LaRue in and told him to talk to the man. LaRue's handling of the man involved looking at this pamphlet and this drawing that was so outrageous. And the man said, why the hell have you got a vulture there? LaRue said innocently, that's not a vulture, that's just a blackbird.
I remember that story. What was the model for the labor program service? Was it the School for Workers of Wisconsin, or was it more the Illinois program? Or did you pretty much just hire Fred and then ask, that was his job to
design? The basic framework of the center had been established before Fred came. Mm-hmm. Fred was given quite a good deal of money and support to organize the labor program. He hired Bob Repas and Jackie Brophy and two or three other very good people. What was your question again?
Just the extent to which you were involved in designing the labor program service.
Oh, you wanted to know if I followed a model.
Or if that was pretty much Haler's.
It was, no, Haler, as I said, the basic foundations had been laid, and I think, as a matter of fact, the board action establishing the center had taken place before Fred came. We had somebody in on an acting basis. I think the name escapes me. Somebody was in on an acting basis with the understanding that Fred was coming.
Was it ever a major issue that LPS faculty would be given tenure, even though many of them didn't have PhDs?
That's another problem area that became apparent during my 4 or 5 years as the director of the center. We started out with the idea, I should say I started out, it was my idea. We started out emphasizing that either staff people for this new enterprise would be taken from a regular established department, tenure and all, and newcomers would be granted tenure and academic rank in the appropriate department, mainly economics, but in some other departments as well. Well, that turned out to be something of a mistake. The administration of a joint appointment has many difficulties. There are many difficulties inherent in this joint appointment.
But all your early appointees were that. LaRue was economics and here.
Yes,
Stieber
yes.
was economics and
right.
here.
Stieber had a tenure appointment in economics.
Kruger must have been economics in
Kruger here. Kruger was another. And well, I think we had something of a tussle with the economics department. There were one or two people in the Department of Economics who were very strongly opposed to the idea of joint appointments. in the center. They were not very supportive of the idea of a center, and by refusing to give their assent to a tenured position in the economics department, they thought they could maybe derail this operation. Well, what we did, and this again with the understanding and support of John Hanna, we established a rank in the school, or it was still the center. And we gave the people who at that time had joint appointments, myself, Jack, I think Kruger had been recommended, and there was static from economics because they didn't think Kruger was good enough for the economics department. Big hassle over that. And of course I agreed to a joint appointment for myself in economics. I'd been in economics for 10 or 12 years by that time. I had some claims to my tenure in economics, although recent years I've drifted away from it. But finally, that got to be so bothersome, so time-consuming, so just so much friction involved in these appointments. Economics wanted to control the amount of salary increase for their tenured people and apply the same standards of judgment to our joint appointment people that they applied to their full-time faculty. Had to have publication. That was one big complaint, I think, about Kruger. Well, he had a PhD. Well, Fred was one of those involved. Fred did not have a PhD himself. Rebus didn't. Jackie Brophy didn't. So I had not yet gotten around to submitting them. I didn't want to take on another big fight. But it became apparent that economics would do everything possible to sabotage this operation over here, so long as we had the joint appointments. So I decided we'd better just abandon that idea. It was not a sound idea. And I think Hanna agreed with me fairly quickly. And rank was established. I don't think anybody stood on a hill and blew a trumpet, but it was established while I was still director.
And at that time, a similar decision about not a major emphasis on research and publication for the extension faculty was reached internally here?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. No, it was foolish to expect Fred Haler to sit down and write these these weighty articles for the professional press of the economics department. That's not what we hired him for. We hired him to run an extension program for labor. And he would be less effective if he would have been less effective if he had tried to carry a burden of research. And that, of course, was the big sticking point with the economics department. I had a reasonable record, not the most outstanding record, but I did have a book in that had been published by the University of Chicago Press, and then the Johns Hopkins book on trade union publications, that had come out. I published 8 or 10 articles. Well, I had more or less the credentials, and then nobody ever attacked me, although I think there were there was some consideration of it. But I stood up pretty well under the academic standards. And anyway, I had the tenure already well established by board action. So I never tackled from that standpoint.
Actually, just a couple more questions. I actually just fill in a couple gaps on different things. Back during the Senate hearings, there's a fairly famous document called The People's Colleges by John Hanna, which the National Labor Movement utilized in the AFL Federationists back in 61, which was a reprint of Hanna's testimony before the Senate hearings.
Mm-hmm.
Was that something that we probably were involved with? I mean, Fred or you or Jack crafted this kind of a document, or was Hanna that involved with the school that these are really, I'm not trying to belittle his involvement, but it's a very, very supportive notion of labor
yes,
extension.
It is. The senator kept John Hanna in the witness chair an entire day, even though Hanna had said at the beginning that he had some things that he had to do out of the campus, and he would appreciate it if his testimony was limited, and if necessary, he'd come back. Well, this whole thing, this whole hullabaloo was directed against John Hanna,
uh-huh,
as anybody else. I had never heard of Francis before this thing came up, and I suppose that Rogers had fed Francis some ideas. But anyway, John Hanna sat there. He read this entire statement. Nobody in the center had anything to do with it. He had a press representative named Dennison, who was a very bright, very well-informed man. I suspect he wrote it using John Hanna's instructions, main points.
I was just curious the extent to which it indicates Hanna was supportive.
Oh yes,
of
he
the
was,
university
was,
doing labor extension in addition to
was,
agricultural and business extension.
He was very supportive from day one until he left the presidency.
What is your feeling? You mentioned about that he read the times and the wind in terms of the increasing union influence in the state. Was he also friends with, or have confidants like a Sexton or others in the labor movement?
Don Stevens was his main connection with the labor movement. I believe that Hanna took part. We had some receptions, mainly at my home, for these outside speakers, like Walter Reuther and
mm-hmm.
John Galbraith, and I can't remember the names of the other people. We invited Hanna, and if his schedule permitted, he came out to my house and helped to greet these bigwigs from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not remember one single complaint that Hanna ever voiced in my presence about the establishment of this enterprise, the School of Labor and Industrial Relations. He was very supportive. And a major part of his being supportive was he left us alone.
Okay. Did you say it was his idea to change from a center to a school in 62?
Yes. This was after this humiliating experience of being forced to sit on that witness chair all day long down on this hearing. And he talked about it. Switch it to a school, put it under a dean, let the dean take the flak.
Okay.
I've got other things that I have to take care of. Deans can handle these things better. So that is why we changed to a school.
Whose idea was to create the Master's in Labor Industrial Relations degree in 65, and was there a particular model for that?
Well, Cornell had a degree program in industrial relations, labor and industrial relations.
So it was kind of on their model.
To some extent.
I mean, I understand Bill Form chaired a committee that involved some of the people in the center to look at that.
Could be. By that time, I was out of the directorship.
Do you remember?
And I was not involved in the process of changing the name. I told Jack some of my misgivings. And he said, well, I think we can overcome the problem. And he said, well, my feeling was that there wasn't enough material, publications, investigations, etc., to support a 1 year, or actually a 1.5 year program for a master's degree in this field. Well, the field has grown since we established the center.